X5. Number 2A.
We come to a next point, 6. Just one little step further. The title will be Understanding Both, : the nothingness of error and the somethingness of truth. Understanding both the nothingness of error and the somethingness of truth. We'll always see in Mrs. Eddy's writings that she would show that these apparently opposite statements should be seen as one and that they constitute one. She, for instance, already in the chapter on prayer, she would say that we should deny sin and plead God's allness. See, it's on one side to deny sin, to see its nothingness, and on the other side to plead God's allness. She just doesn't say, well, plead for God's allness. It's really two-sided, and we are apt to forget one side. Whichever side it is, we are apt to forget it. And in order to have the whole theory, we must also stick to that statement. She says about Jesus that Jesus' two cardinal points of mind healing, calls them two cardinal points of mind healing. And when we ask, what are they? The one again is seeing the nothingness of nothing and the allness of the somethingness, namely to understand the nothingness of material life and intelligence. See? To understand the nothingness of it, and second, to understand the mighty actuality of all-inclusive God good. So it isn't that Jesus' cardinal point of mind healing was to understand the mighty actuality of all-inclusive God good. It was two-sided, it had two views on it, and both together were his two cardinal points. She also said that the Christian scientists have enlisted to lessen evil. On which ground? By understanding their nothingness, that's one side, and understanding the allness of God good. So can you see, in treatment, in trying to see the reality and solving a problem, at this level, actually, I always must point out, we are at the level of Christian science, the absolute Christian science, not on divine science. This is all true on this level. We jolly well have to see not only the allness of truth, but then also see why and how error is nothing. And naturally we can do that by going through the seven synonymous terms and enlarge on this fundamental statement. It's not enough then just to state these two cardinal points, but naturally it is understanding them, and we understand them by taking them through the seven synonymous terms and see the allness of them and the nothingness of their counterfeits. Also of the Revelator, she says that he sees the nothingness of evil, and second, the allness of God. So the Revelator really was the revelation of John, that book which really would see through error to its highest degree. No book of the Bible would analyze error and the ways and means of error so as the book of Revelation does, and it stands for the highest revelation. You see again, the highest revelation stands on what? That the Revelator could see right through the claims of evil. Or Jesus himself would say always the same thing, your communication be yea, yea, and nay, nay. He didn't say, just say yea, yea. He said also, nay, nay. And therefore he said, this kind of disease does not go out but by prayer and fasting. Prayer stands for acknowledging the truth. Fasting stands for denying error. So we see how in Jesus' teaching, in the teaching of John the Revelator, in the teaching of Mrs. Eddy, always these two facets, these two sides of the coin are brought out and said, don't leave one out. Take both, and you have the whole teaching. We come to another point, 7, that therefore, the title would be Protection Against Evil. Mrs. Eddy would point out over and over that we should be watchful in our mentality, in our consciousness, and see that we guard ourselves against evil, that evil cannot make us a channel of evil, so that we are not allowing evil to make use of us. And we'll see when we go through the textbook then together that this is the main point of one of the 16th chapter, which points out, don't let yourself be used by error. Protect yourself, therefore. How can you do that? She says in the chapter on teaching that we should thoroughly fit our students to defend themselves against error. That we should guard ourselves against animal magnetism. That we should watch that evil suggestions take no root in our thought. See, we should watch that nothing that comes to us takes root in our thought. It comes to us and we should look fairly into its face and see through it, but not to let it in. So handling evil does not mean you welcome error and you take it in your consciousness, but you let it come to the door, as far as the door, you ram the door, and you see how you can reject error. So, by handling error, we do not take it in. That's sometimes voice too, that they say, well, if you handle error, you let it in. We don't let it in. We see through it. We don't let it in. Yes. The next point, 8, we could look at it like this, that evil and good are not two. Evil and good are not two. So this is a further step in the development of handling evil, that now when we have seen that the nothingness of evil and the allness of truth is one, we can therefore see then actually we must culture our consciousness to the point where we do no more think of good and evil as two. That we gain an attitude that we see those two as one. That they are not two, but one. So in this way only we begin to resolve duality. How can we do that? Well, we know that evil and good are not two entities, not two realities. Therefore, if they are not two realities, then we must say, then there is only one reality. But why then do we judge and distinguish between good and evil? We distinguish good and evil, this is the point, not because there are entities, but because we have a belief in two. So good and evil are one in so far, and we experience it in so far as our concept of good and evil changes, and we see that one is a nothingness and the other is a somethingness, and then there is just somethingness. It is quite interesting to see how she argues this out, especially also in prose work and so on, that she would show that actually good and evil are not two realities, but two ways of arguing within ourselves about one and the same thing. That we argue as if we would be two persons, as if we would be two. You know, that's how you argue within yourself, once pro and once con. Huh? And yet we are always one. We are always what we are. We are not two. But we argue in a dualistic sense. We waver between one and the other extreme. So it shows very easily it's only one thing, but two ways of looking at things. Namely, one way is looking at it wrongly, and the other is to look at it rightly. So the thing itself is beyond good and evil. It's not even a question, is something good or evil? It's beyond that fact, that distinction. But our conceptual sense of it is dualistic. And therefore, where it has to be corrected is within our concept. We have to give up that arguing within ourselves. She says, there are not two realities of being, good and evil, two opposite states of existence. One should appear real to us and the other unreal. You see, she takes it right back to how it appears, not to what they are as existence. She takes it away from the ontological question, from the existential question, and puts it right into a metaphysical question. What do I attribute to one and the same thing? Do I attribute to one and the same thing something that is good, or do I attribute to that very something something that is evil? He says, if mortals could grasp, it's a grasping, understanding, grasp these two words, all and nothing, this mystery of a God who has no knowledge of sin would disappear. See, again, we have heard that she began, that she had that mystery of error, which she had to solve. Here she shows how to solve it. That the two great words are all and nothing. And that if we would really grasp the meaning of them, that all is all, and that nothing is actually nothing, we would see that all is all. And that would be the answer, and the mystery would disappear. And it's interesting that she says that the mystery of a God who has a knowledge of sin would disappear. Can you see? Here she speaks of the knowledge of God that God has. Before she was talking about the knowledge we have, the relative sense. We give to something the quality of good or of evil. When we begin to understand that the one is all and the other nothing, we can understand why God, who is always all, cannot see nothing. He not even has a knowledge of nothing. That value nothing does not even enter into his standpoint. So in this way we begin to see that by changing, by, let's say, by first reasoning it out on the human level and to see the reality, we begin to realize that from the absolute standpoint it is absolutely clear that God does not know evil. He has just no knowledge of it. God not even argues against evil. He just doesn't know it. If we approach with a problem to God and say, now look here, dear God Almighty, you are a jolly big God, and with you all things are possible. Here I have a problem of frustration, of lack of anything. He says to us, I can't hear you. What are you talking? That vocabulary is unknown to me. It's absolutely unknown. He can never understand what you are talking. Because in God's eye are purer than to hear or see all the talking about evil. But within ourselves, in order to take part in that, we must be clear about the evaluation of a thing. Do we give value to something in the way of good or of evil? It's all up to us. Therefore, she makes that interesting statement, see, which can be misunderstood enormously, that she says, there are not two, - mind and that and is in italics, mind and matter. Can you see that she spells it out very directly? She says, there are not two, mind and matter. If we analyze somehow our thought that when we are not consciously thinking scientifically, when we are just hearing the talks of, well, naturally, mind and matter, isn't it so that somehow, before we can control our consciousness, we think of two? We say they are opposites, they are antitheses. And so we think of them as two. No matter if then we say the one is real and the other is unreal, but we still think of two. But she says there are not two. Because she speaks from the standpoint of absolute Christian science, and there she can say, there are not two. There is only one, and that's mind. From the relative standpoint, from the human standpoint, we still have a conceptual sense, but not an isness sense. You see, that word are is from the verb is, the plural of is. The isness sense, the existential sense, we can never make mind and matter two things from the ontological sense. Only in belief we make two. And that's the whole issue about ending evil. The whole issue. It always reduces it to that very simple point. And we'll see how on this simple point her completely different logic is built in the Christian Science textbook. Therefore, we see why she uses all sorts of terms in order to bring out that mind and matter are not two, and yet to explain the terminology, and in order to explain the apparent opposites. She speaks that evil is only, say, a negative definition of good. Therefore, those many statements in her writings where she said, actually, with the human language and on that level, in order to bring out what is life, you have to use the term death. In order to bring out really on the human level what is truth, you have to bring out and bring in the term error, the opposite, without making it two businesses, two actualities. She says, on another way, in order to explain that they are not two, and yet to give to each one somehow a definition, she says that evil is a counterfeit of good, or error is a counterfeit of truth. It is not a counterfact. See, the moment they would be counterfacts, she couldn't say there are not two, mind and matter. But the moment she says one is a counterfeit is always something you take from the original. It's not something by itself, it has no existence by itself, so it's a counterfeit. But we are apt to think in counterfacts. We must always analyze honestly our reaction which we have. We take a language, but we never read a language as what it means. We at once somehow interpret and interpolate something into it, and therefore mistake it, always. That's how the human mind is built. We read, therefore, that evil is a counterfeit of good, and so we say, oh yes, it's the opposite of good, it's therefore something else. And we have already made it an isness. They have already made two, a counterfact. In Mrs. Hall's teaching, you never encounter the word counterfact. Never. It would destroy her old teaching. It's always a counterfeit. So, though Mrs. Eddy uses a very vast vocabulary, especially for her age, she never used that common term counterfact, which would be used in philosophy, in religion, and I don't know where. She tries to bring it out in another word. She says, look here, what evil is, it's only simulating good. Simulating. See, she tries to find all sorts of terms just to bring out they are not counterfacts. She always tries to find what kind of terms do I have at hand that I can show. The original always remains the original. That original really remains what it is. The only thing I can do is to misstate it, to misrepresent it, to not understand it. It's a simulation, it's a counterfeit, it's a supposititious opposite. They even use that term, a supposititious opposite, a suppositional opposite. There is a slight difference between that, the supposititious opposite and the oppositional opposite, and actually explains the whole thing very simply, namely by the law of opposites. You have that statement where she said, why are earth and mortals so elaborate in beauty, color, and form if God has no part in them? See, that great question which you hear all over the place. People say, look here at nature. And the deeper you look into nature, the more you know about the behavior of insects and flowers, how they change their color, how they are adapted to certain situations to protect themselves, and so on. You see a terrific richness and intelligence there, which seem to be there to protect all living things, you know, and you say to yourself, man could never think out that. Man could never invent such a thing. Man would not have the ability really to program such a minutely beautiful organism and mechanism into living matter. Therefore, because man cannot think out so highly and so intelligently, therefore, God must have made it. See, always when we can't do it and it's done, then we say it's God or the devil, one or the other. Huh? That's what we do. Huh? But with every stage we know more about things, we begin to be able to do them too. And then we dethrone God, you see, so that's why in the scientific age God is more and more dethroned, because we can understand now the whole plan materially and scientifically materially, and so we think actually we don't need any more God so much as they used to need God, say 500 years ago or 2,000 years ago. And so we say, well, then God must have had his hands in it to bring out such beauty and such elaborate things. And Mrs. Eddy says, no. This is on account of the so-called law of opposites. Because in the human, for every statement we make, we can make an opposite statement. That's how the human mind is built. There's nothing on earth which in the human language you cannot form an opposite. If you say this day is beautiful, you say, no, it's too hot, it's not nice. Yeah, it's so easy. That's language, that's how language is built. You always can state the opposite. And so Mrs. Eddy takes this and shows that actually there is in the human belief that law of opposite that can always reproduce, simulate it through the law of opposite by simulating the whole thing. But that doesn't make it real. See, it's always just giving our attitude. And this our attitude, that's what gives us hell, nothing else. There is no devil that gives us hell, because there doesn't exist the devil. Nor God gives us hell, because God is no hell. The only thing that gives us hell is our approach to that very subject, our complete ignorance about reality. So little by little we begin to find out today that we have never to blame anything or anybody. There is no power outside of our misunderstanding to which we can attribute any evil motive or power or action or law or anything like that. We find everything within ourselves. So we begin to realize, as we have seen, to really handle evil within our beliefs. Yeah. Point 9, see, is evil serves as a waymark for good. Evil serves as a waymark for good. This is a very tricky thing. Oh, good. You see, there are many statements in Mrs. Eddy's writings pointing out that behind evil is something good, that behind the so-called evil experience is a divine idea, is the Christ at work. And she must show that, because the point just before mentioned, where we have seen in that point, what was it, 8, that evil and good are not two, she somehow must now also show how we have to see them as one. And so she must show that that which seems to be evil and show itself forth as error is actually, because it is only a simulation of something true, that therefore we could lead back the erroneous form, the erroneous statement, back to its truth, and that therefore everything that is evil is actually only good misunderstood, and that this evil is a waymark to good. These are her wordings, and therefore she has all those statements where she says science depicts how error reversed is subserving the facts of health. Can you see what she says? That error actually is another way, another mean, another help to bring us to health. She says that by reversal, error serves as a waymark to the one mind. Again, it would seem that error is nothing else but a different kind of formulation of mind, that it serves the purposes of God. Did you listen clearly? I said it seems. Because this is a terrific difficult point, or fine point, which can be misunderstood enormously. She says, science reverses the false testimony of the physical senses, and by this reversal, mortals arrive at the fundamental facts of being. Again, it seems as if evil could be a servant for good. And that naturally can be misunderstood enormously. And I will come back to it later on,